Okay, well, thank you. Now that we've gotten through all the presentations, we're going to start the question and answer session with the questions that have been typed into the chat room. We have a number of questions, so I think I'm just going to start off with the top of the list and just go on down. So the first question is for Janet, and that question is, how would I get involved with the Urban Goods Movement group?
Great, and it bought me some time to make sure I got all of this information. Well, first of all, the person leading that research is actually on the call with us. That's Suzanne Rhodes from Wilbur Smith & Associates out of Ohio. The Urban Goods Movement is not so much a group as it is a national cooperative freight research program project. As part of that project, Suzanne's team will be doing a focus group to check the findings of the guidebook that's underway. And in addition, the idea of the panel overseeing the project was to make sure that there was a robust outreach program following it. So Suzanne popped me a quick email, and she said it was okay to give you her contact information. So Suzanne, you know, you may rue the day. I will also type this in, but if it's Suzanne Rhodes, and her phone number is 614-888-9440, extension 1242, and Suzanne can involve you in that project, or if you've got input for her, or would like to be part of those focus groups, I think she's happy to bring you in. But once that guidebook is done and the estimated end date is early 2011, you'll be able to be part of some of the outreach that is intended for part of that project. So I'll also type that into the chat.
Okay, thank you. And actually, I think I saw Suzanne just did type all that in. So.
Oh, see, there you go.
Yeah, we do have that information. Okay, great, thanks. The next question is actually for directed for all presenters, and I'll let anybody jump in. Are there any regulations, ordinances, etc., that restrict freight growth or competition by any given mode in your state or region or at the national level? And I'll let any one of the presenters who wants to jump in.
This is Eric. We don't have anything like that is restrictive by mode. If we do have anything, it may be just overarching in general, but it's not mode specific.
In Indiana, we have one regulation on trucking, where we don't allow it heavier weight to come into the state compared to some of the states surrounding us. So, like, if a truck is coming from Michigan to Indiana, there's these little stops in Michigan before they get into Ohio where they have to transfer sometimes the product over because they have heavier weight limits. So it's an issue that we're working on trying to get fixed here in the state, but that's one issue in one particular mode that we have that probably puts us at a competitive disadvantage with some of the states around us. And each state's different when it comes to truck weight limits.
I think this is one of the things that we've asked the Urban Goods Movement study group to look at so that we can provide information through that guidebook to states and localities of what the implications of different ordinances. I know things that have been brought up are things like time of day movements, restrictions on when deliveries can occur, because don't forget that this isn't just about intercity or interstate freight, but goods movement is something that happens 24/7 and in different forms. I know some of the things I've also heard, Homeland Security regulations can be restrictive, different modes that goods can move on, whether rail lines need to be relocated. So there are impacts sort of across the board, I think, but I don't know of a really good resource that would provide a list of those things.
Hey, this is Eric. American Trucking Association, they probably would have a very good resource of, there may be things such as idling. Some states would allow trucks to idle, and some states have very good truck parking. There is trying to be a standardization of the weight of the trucks. think everybody's around 80,000 pounds. There are some that will allow 100,000 pounds, but it depends on the permit and a specialized permit. But I believe for ATA may have some of that information available.
Speed limits are also one of those issues, too, that are different from state to state via truck mode.
Okay. Well, thank you for all the great information. The next question, how does one fairly plan for investments that untie local congestion bottlenecks of freight with the fact that many of the economic benefits are regional and not local? And again, I'll open that up to any of the presenters.
Let me give you a quick philosophical answer. First of all, I'm hoping, you know, Wendy, know that you are not alone in asking this question. I think this is frankly one of the fundamental problems right now with trying to even get a surface transportation bill passed in Washington. We've gone from a point in infrastructure where people understood that we needed to build roads in Montana or Wyoming to get freight in and out of California or New Jersey. Now that we have a fairly mature system, a lot of people are saying, well, why should I make an investment here when the benefits are so diffuse? And I wish I had a really good answer to that question. I think that's one of the things that we've got to grapple with, because there are going to be investments in particular and bottlenecks that need to be made that do have much broader benefits but require some sort of local entity to ultimately make that decision. So it's a great question. I sure wish I had a good answer for you.
We've done something here in Indiana. Governor Daniels, working with the Kentucky governor, I think his name's Bashir. We've created a public-private partnership with Kentucky and created a commission to do the Ohio River Bridges project, because that's really a regional project that benefits both Kentucky, Indiana, and really kind of Cincinnati as well. So we created a special commission that's got appointees from both states. They've also, this group together, decided to, you know, allow for user fees or some sort of tolls in order to pay for the infrastructure bill, because the federal government can pay for part of it, but they don't have enough money to finish completion of the project. So the locals then, through either a toll or a fee or some other, you know, public-private partnership agreement, would be able to fund the rest of the project. So they're working out all that details now, but both legislatures in both states approved similar legislation and moved it and have been working cooperative on that one project. And same thing with the Illion Expressway project, which is up by Chicago and Gary, between the state of Indiana and Illinois. So there's some models out there of some communities that have regional, but really they're, you know, so like the Louisville, Jeffersonville area, or the Jeffersonville, New Albany versus Louisville, in the end, the states really, I think, are the ones that got to step up in those regional instances and help those local communities make those, investments and help make things happen.
That is absolutely true. And I'll tell you, case in point, even what we have outlined in our state rail plan, there are investments which are happening in certain areas where people will say, you know, why are you making so much of an investment in Philadelphia or in Pittsburgh when us in the northern tier aren't reaping the benefit of that, which that isn't necessarily true. But at least there is the plan out there to give it that 30,000-foot perspective of, okay, this is where we're making investment. This is why that, even though it's not in your county or in your region per se, but it has a benefit for the better of Pennsylvania as a whole. Now, that's probably one of the reasons why things can be rather fragmented from the national level. I know FRA is developing a national rail plan or a national freight plan as we speak, but just because there has been that vortex at the national level for what a national plan would look like and where national investment should go, that would help entice to make investments that are a little bit more regional, to make investments that necessarily aren't in my region or in my state, but have an impact. Case in point, there is a tunnel in Maryland, which is the Baltimore Avenue Tunnel. It's about a mile long. It's single tracked, single stacked. That it's owned by CSX. That tunnel had caught on fire about several years ago, and it had a major impact all throughout the Northeast, because nothing could get through. Nothing could go north. Nothing could go south. context doesn't, well, hasn't made the commitment to go that far, how could I get Pennsylvania to contribute to that, or New York, or North Carolina, or the feds to do that? It is just a hard thing to tackle at the moment, but we are getting better.
In another example, you know, the Sioux Lock and the Olmsted Lock that I talked about earlier, the reason they're part of our plan, neither one of those are in Indiana. The Sioux Lock is actually at the tip of Michigan, and Olmsted, which is the feeder into the Mississippi, is basically, you know, in Illinois. But we went to some of our delegation members from, say, Indianapolis. Well, how are they affected by the river? Well, guess what? You know, we're a heavy agricultural intensive state, and most of that ag is produced in the 4th and the 6th district, which are on the west and the east side of the state. Most of that stuff goes via rail down to the water, where then they put them onto the boats and then ship them down that. If that lock goes down, that has an impact on the farmers that live in those districts. So what we have done is we went to the General Assembly here in Indiana and asked them to contact the delegation members from Indiana, saying, this is a problem for Indiana. And from that, then Conexus has also made contacts with Ohio and some of the other states surrounding us, saying, this is what we did in Indiana. We would encourage you to do the same thing, because in the end, we're all impacted by this, and hopefully that will press those members to say, we need to get these projects started and make them happen now.
Okay, thank you. We are having some great discussion here, and it sounds like we have some good questions. The next one is, Eric, it's directed to you, but actually any of the speakers could jump in as well. Are you or any of the other speakers aware of funding available to towns, cities, or counties for rail and road railroad bridge replacements? The structures are obsolete, and the low clearance causes overheight vehicles to take alternative routes. New structures could enhance the gateways to several communities, encouraging travelers to enter the city rather than avoid it.
I am not familiar with any funding sources to go directly for municipalities for railroad bridges. Other infrastructure, we do have things in Pennsylvania for that, particularly the road bridges and roads underneath. Bridges are something, that's actually something we're studying in Pennsylvania. Railroad bridges, even though they were built to last 100 years, oh, they were probably built about 120 years ago. They are actually in a position where there's some of them are becoming structurally deficient, and the railroads are beginning to recognize and beginning to work on it. But some of the, if you're not a Class 1 or regional railroad, if you're a short line, you just do not have the financing to take on a bridge of because they're rather capital intensive, very expensive to build. But I am not familiar with any programs specifically for railroad bridges over local roads. Now, we, through our grant program, I can assist the railroad with that.
David or Janet, are you aware of anything?
This is Janet. I'm not, other than what might happen on a state-by-state basis. So I'm not aware of anything really at the federal level.
Well, yeah, I'm not aware of anything on the federal or the state level here in Indiana that would do that. I mean, there are options. You know, we're trying to build an intermodal facility, and we're going to do it through the private sector, and we're going to do it really through probably a bonding process where the users then pay for the facility that they use. So you could use a similar type mechanism for different projects if you can get buy-off from your governor or your sort of state economic development folks. But in the end, it wouldn't be just free money. It would be bonding that would pay it back, but it would be paid for it back by the users who ever used that kind of project.
Okay, thank you. The next question is for Janet. Given that federal resources are limited in these economic times, which freight mode would you say has the most urgent need for investment if the goal is to improve economic competitiveness, and why? I heard you mention marine transportation because of the expected growth in the export of bulk and agricultural goods.
You know, that's a very interesting question, and I'm going to say I think it's a false choice to say it's one mode or the other. I think we've focused for a very, very long time on the mode piece of this, and really it's a question of looking geographically and in terms of the different economic slices of the economy. It's more of a location choice, and it's a matter of performance. So question more of, you know, are we going to focus on relieving congestion? Are we going to look at that last mile intermodal connector, whether it's rail or road, or simply at an entire sort of port region and figure out how do we make that work the best? There are a lot of people that, because we do have a real difficult situation in terms of paying for infrastructure, and that is the barrier right now to moving anything in Washington, who want to retreat and say, well, that's it. I'm going to look at my own mode, and I'm going to promote my own mode, and that's going to be the best way to go. And I think I thought something actually that was said about the need to go back to real transportation planning, real long-term, what are the overall needs, what are we trying to deliver, is what really has got to, what's really got to drive investments. And it's more of a question of how do you measure performance and then make the right investments for performance, which in some case will be about technology and management and not necessarily investing in a particular mode per se.
I think Janet's right. I mean, you know, in Indiana, you know, the reason we did our plan was because we didn't think one mode was more important than the other. What we thought was that they're all tied together. I do have to say one thing that the federal government is responsible for, though, is the waterways. They always have been. They're the ones who actually built most of the waterway infrastructures. And unfortunately, you know, when the stimulus package, you know, passed, there was money for roads. There was money for, you know, even rail through Tiger grants. The one area that really was, you know, there was no increase in funding. In fact, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers was pretty much flat funded was the waterways. And I am worried about that infrastructure funding, though. The waterway fund is going broke, just like the Highway Trust Fund. And in the end, that's one structure that the feds need to take care of that they're not. And, you know, if one of these locks go down, it can have devastating consequences in multiple states.
Amen to that.
Eric, do you have anything to add?
In the interest of time, I'm pretty good. I think they summed it up fairly well.
Okay, great. Thank you. Eric, I think this next one is more meant for you, but in regard to rail freight, has there been any resistance from trucking freight? Are they worried about losing business?
No. Like I said, I mean, there is always friendly competition between them, but they are in a position where they realize that they do need some help because they are losing drivers, and it's hard to attract drivers. And many of their drivers just don't want to go the long haul anymore. They all want to actually come home at night, or a good portion of them want to. And now, do they want? They do not like losing business, of course. Particularly now, as things are very tight and very competitive, they do not want to lose business. But they realize if they're going for the longer haul, and they do know that. There are regulations out there, and they do have issues with their own personnel, and there is the issues of traffic and congestion. If they are going to survive, they may need to just do things a little differently, and the railroads have to realize that as well.
If I could add on to that,
sure.
You know, most of the truckers that I talk to in Indiana are supportive of intermodal, and I'll tell you why, because they make more profit off their margins by doing short hauls than long hauls. They're really trying to get away more from the long hauls because of the fuel prices. And secondly, a lot of these trucking firms now are becoming third-party logistics providers where they add value. So, you know, like somebody will send them something as one of their products, and they'll package it for them instead of them packaging it. Then they'll distribute it for them. And so because of that, they need to use the intermodal a lot more. And it seems like they're not just open to it, but they're really interconnected now with the rails, where before they were very separate entities. They're really not so much anymore.
And I think where I see the industries fighting with each other, the industry groups, is when someone tries to say, we need to move truck off of rail, and therefore we don't need to invest in our highways. And as you can imagine, because this is a highly politicized environment here, there are folks who say who want to make that statement, rails are better than trucks, it's better for the environment, therefore we shouldn't drive, we shouldn't invest in highways, we should take our money and we should put it in rail. That's taking it the step too far, and I think that's where you see the industry groups start to balk. Because it's not, you know, the case is no matter how much freight you move off of highways and onto rails, we still have to maintain, modernize, and expand the roads as well. But, you know, we routinely have, you know, our members who are trucking and railroads say, look, we're each other's best customers. So, you know, trying to keep that out of being politicized, I think, helps the matter.
Yeah, Janet is absolutely correct. To get into the debate that make it shift the investment from one mode and neglect the other is absolutely not helpful, and it does not, it just shifts the problem. It does not create a better environment for economic development.
Okay, thank you. The next question is also for Eric. What is the source of state funds for the rail investments?
We have a $40 million program. It's actually broken up into two separate programs. One, the Rail Freight Assistance Program, is a roughly $10 million general fund appropriation. It comes right out of the general fund. And we have a $30 million capital bond. It's basically bond proceeds.
Okay, thank you. The next question, I actually probably should have addressed this earlier, but Janet, could you repeat? You made a comment earlier about building roads in Montana or Wyoming.
Yeah, and I actually popped merely a quick response, but the gist of it is I think at some point we've started losing sight of the fact that this is a national transportation system and it's a network. It is now harder, I think, at least when we're talking about a federal highway system, to convince a congressman from South Carolina that there's value in their dollars going to Wyoming. I mean, this is the whole donor-donee debate, right? And so somehow we've got to be able to make investments that do have and show broader-based benefits. But it's, you know, I think this is at the heart of a lot of the debates at both the state and the national level.
Thank you. The next question is for all presenters. It's a long one, but I'm going to read it out here. While the potential benefits of shifting freight from truck to rail, such as environmental, fuel savings, etc., are impressive, how much do you think the public sector can really influence and promote the desire to effect a freight mode shift when so much of the freight movement is a private sector decision? And the fact that there are a number of dynamics that influence what freight movements go into truck versus rail, such as distance for freight hauls, local deliveries, operating margins for freight movements, and efficiencies.
Well, from Indiana's perspective, and I'll just tell you the discussions we've had, railroads are really looking for public-private partnerships where the states don't necessarily give them money, but they might be willing to issue a bond that then the private sector pays for, whatever. What the states can do is help facilitate or help, you know, working with the railroad. In the end, though, I think you're right. It is the private sector in the end that will end up paying for a lot of the, especially on the rail, on the intermodal and multimodal side. And it's going to be up to the railroads to make those investments, because the rail, up until the last few years, really never took any federal money. I mean, just recently they've been seeking these public-private partnerships, and part of that's because they haven't invested in their lines as much as they should have, and some of it's starting to fall apart. So I think that it's going to be important to have the state supportive of the efforts to try to get, you know, rail activity, but not necessarily fund it.
This is Eric. You're correct. I mean, if you look at what we have in our rail plan, we don't own any of this infrastructure, and they could honestly do whatever they want. But we do have a very competitive program, and they want public dollars to help them in their and maintaining their infrastructure. But if they do want the public dollars, these are some of the things that we are looking for, and these are things that we would like to see. They could choose it to take it or not. What the purpose of making the investments, and it's not so much the railroad or the trucking, it's because they're shippers, they're middlemen. What it is the manufacturers and the distributors. You make the investments into both the highway and the rail and the port and the airport system to give the distributors and those manufacturers choice, and you let them choose. You let the shippers compete, whichever works best for the manufacturer to get the product to wherever it needs to be. That's basically what we're doing. We're not trying to do a sea change here. It's basically we're just providing other options for choice, and choice is competition, and competition is good.
Thank you. Janet, you have anything?
I think that the ability, you know, we can all talk about it all we want, but fundamentally, it's a business decision. How do I get my product to the right destination in good condition at the right price for what I'm selling it for? Unless you're really starting to talk about deep subsidization of one mode over the other, you can try and change the cost structure, but, you know, fundamentally, we are trying to maintain a free market economy. So I think it's gonna be up to the shippers, and it may be useful on a future webinar to try and grab some of those shippers, somebody from retail, manufacturing, energy and natural resources, and pick their brains on, you know, how they make the decisions that they do.
Thank you. Our next seminar, actually, it's a slightly different topic, but I'll get into that in a little bit, but we actually do have some, I think the plan is to have some shippers on there. The next question is, one of the speakers mentioned changes in freight traffic projected to occur with the Panama Canal widening. Is there a study available that documents that this growth and related assumptions?
Gosh, I'm sure there is, but I don't know offhand. I'd have to Google around for it.
I believe there is, and I think Cambridge Systematics has put something together on it.
Okay, if there's anybody, I think we do have a few people in attendance from Cambridge. If any of you are aware of it, please feel free to type the information into the chat box, or if anybody else is aware of the study.
I've heard of other things. Trans Systems would have that information as well, which is another company like Cambridge Systematics, because they're the ones who've given me that data, so I don't know where they got it from.
Okay. Thank you. This one's for David. What was the expressway agreement between governors that you mentioned? Does it involve NN designation for freight standards? Over what time frame did you conduct your phase one initial study?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what an NN designation for freight standards are. In regard to the expressway agreement, meaning that the agreements between the states, they were signed, I don't know if they were memorandums of understanding, but both legislatures, you know, in the case of the Illion Expressway up by Chicago, there was a bill signed by the Indiana General Assembly that allowed for public-private partnerships, both for the Ohio River Bridges and the Illion Expressway. So that's the one down by Louisville and the one by Chicago. So the governor signed an agreement both with Governor Beshear from Kentucky on the one, and they created this commission, and then he just assigned another sort of memorandum of understanding with the state of Illinois on starting the building process for the Illion Expressway. So what there are in essence, are one is more of a funding mechanism down in southern Indiana, and a commission put together in order to figure out how they're going to finance the whole project. The same thing up in Illinois, except for where Ohio River Bridges has sort of already started a lot of their, you know, environmental impact studies, Illiana is just finishing up on theirs. And so I think what will happen is they'll probably end up putting a commission similar to what they did down in on the Ohio River for Illiana, so the two states can have, you know, the entities working together with appointees from both governors. So I hope that explains it. I'm not sure if it did.
Thank you. And actually, and then just to clarify, Mr. Stewart did type in National Network.
I don't believe so. I mean, it could have. I'd have to check on that from NDOT whether that's the case or not. In regard to over what time frame did we conduct our study for phase one, basically we started in the summer of 08 and we finished February of 10. So it was about a year and a half. And we had probably six meetings with the group of CEOs, and we had about every month we had a task force meeting with each of the business leaders who assigned their specialists who really knew the stuff in all those four different areas of infrastructure, public policy, workforce development, and public awareness. And once we got all the due diligence done and we put it together, brought it back to the CEOs, and then they confirmed it at the end of last year, and then we had some due diligence to do before we put the report out, which we put out the end of March.
Okay, thank you. I don't currently see, actually we got one more question just come in. in what ways can regional land use planning work together with these larger transportation projects? And I'll put this out to any of the speakers who want to address it.
It doesn't work without regional land use planning. It's just that simple.
Janet or David, you want to add anything?
I think you got to include them in the process. I mean, I got to tell you, the way we did things in Indiana was we wanted to say what the business leaders throughout the state who are in all these different sectors felt that we needed. Then we pulled in those specialists from the MPOs and the different organizations and said, okay, this is what they're saying they need. What are you currently underway doing? And that helped us sort of prioritize things and figure out what made sense to go with and what didn't. And our CEOs supported some things that the MPOs were very supportive of, and there were some things, you know, and I'll give you an example. US 30 is not on NDOT's planning list, and it's becoming, they're putting a bunch of, it goes from Fort Wayne to Valparaiso, and it's basically a bypass around the, it's basically a shorter route. Well, what's happening is they're putting all these stoplights in. We're trying to get that stopped. That was not in NDOT's planning list, but once we put it in there, NDOT was, they looked at us and said, you know, you're right, we need to make sure that doesn't happen. So now they're working with us to make that happen. So I think we've worked with them, and honestly, we've agreed with them on 99% of the items, so it's only that 1% that you got to work through.
Thank you. Anybody else?
You know, I think that there are, and again, I'm going to have to do a little bit of digging, but there are some examples of some of this regional planning that are out there that we might be able to provide some, you know, provide some good examples of what's going on. But I do think it's, you've got to get the people who are doing land use, you've got to get local officials, you have to get transportation officials, but then also, as David said, you've got to have the users of the system, you know, all talking on the same page, which is a lovely thing for me to do sitting here from Washington, where my job is to talk about this stuff. It's a completely different thing for all of you to actually put into action.
And the Indianapolis Airport on land use, you know, they basically just changed, the airport expanded, and they built new runways, and they built a new terminal. And so we got the old terminal sitting around for land use, and people are trying to decide what they are going to do. So the Indianapolis Airport's done something very, that company you were talking about in Ohio, I think that's the company they hired to do this study. And what we're trying to do is figure out, working with all the NPO planners, working with the business community, working with the government leaders, we're going to try to decide how that land use is actually done and try to actually create a plan on how to use it in the future so it's not, you know, just some mall or something that comes in there. So in the end, hopefully we'll be able to come up with a cohesive plan. I think Columbus and Louisville have both had these sort of networks that look at these kind of things. So those are a couple of models you might want to look at besides, you know, what's happening here in Indianapolis.
Okay, thank you. We are about out of time, so I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up for the day. I don't see any other questions typed in. I don't think we're going to have, we're not, we won't do any questions over the phone today, but I don't think there are many people on the phone line. And, you know, hopefully if you were able to type in your question. If you had another question and we didn't get to answer it, please feel free to contact the speakers or send it to the Freight Planning Listserv. But I want to thank all three presenters. We had a great seminar today, a lot of great discussion during the question and answer session. I think everybody really appreciated it. I know I learned a lot. The recorded version of today's event will be available on the Talking Freight website in the next, I think I had to say the next week in the beginning, probably more like the next 2 to 3 weeks, but I'll send it on email once it is available. As a reminder, if you're an AICP member and would like to receive 1.5 certification maintenance credits for attending today, please make sure you are either signed in with your first and last name, or if you were with a group and you weren't the one that logged in, please just make sure your name is typed into the chat box. And there's an evaluation form in the file share box. Please, everybody, if you could fill it out and send it back to me. We want to make sure these seminars are working as well as possible for you. So if you could just fill it in and send it back to me, that'd be great. The next seminar will be held on July 21st and will be about freight productivity impacts by natural and man-made disasters. We do currently have a speaker from UPS on that one, and we're working on getting some other industry people to present. If you haven't done so already, I encourage you to visit the Talking Freight website and sign up for the July 21st seminar. The address is up on the slide on your screen, and I'll take down the poll in a minute so you can see it better. And I also encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you haven't already done so. So thank you, Janet, David, and Eric, and thank you, everybody, for attending today.